the early service that I did, I had to stick pretty close to the manuscript, the text. And usually the only reason I do text or manuscript is so I don't run too long. Otherwise, things tend to get carried away. But and when you got one service following another, you got to keep it pretty short. And I tend to wander even when I have a manuscript. I tend to get off. But you guys can get the full boat here because you don't have anything following. I can go as long as I want, I guess. Before I actually start with the sermon this morning, I want to tell you a little bit about myself. Some of you know me. My most noted claim to fame is sitting in the second row here, is Brenda Alexander, is my wife, and I'm her husband. And usually I've been sitting out there, and she's been up here pulpit supplying for you. She is the director of spiritual care for Presbyterian Homes in Lake Johanna. They got a new name now, but there's something close to that. I mean, they're always changing names in the corporate world, but that's the large flagship home, this first Presbyterian home that was started is out on Lake Johanna, and that's where she is senior chaplain at. I retired in the last Sunday of June in 2009, and this is the first time I've preached since. So it may go extra long because I've got it built up for 2.5 years that we go. The other thing, but most of that, and before that, I was at Oliver Presbyterian Church in South Minneapolis with. And before that, I was interim pastor out at the Presbyterian Church in Spicer, Minnesota. And when I was out of Spicer, I had my first introduction to immigrant ministries. I came to Spicer at just about the time the Somali first came to Minnesota. And there was a lot of conflict going on out at Wilmer and in that area between the Hispanics, who had traditionally worked at the turkey plants, processing turkeys, and the Somalis that came. And until the Somalis came, many of the Hispanics that worked in were good workers, and they would come to and work in the factory, and they would be there for 3 months or 6 months, and one day they wouldn't show up. They'd be gone for 3 weeks, a month, and then they'd come back again and assume their job would be waiting for them. They had decided to go back to Mexico for a while. And that happened all the time. And I know this because the chief operating officer of Genio was in my congregation at Spicer, and he was telling me about this. And then when they started hiring the Somali, they discovered that they were always, always at work. They never missed a day. They never left for any reason. They had no other homes to go to. This was where they were at. They were always discovering somebody that had a doctorate degree working gutting turkeys. They were educated, not in English, but they were educated. And that was causing a lot of friction between the Hispanic community and the Somali community. That was back in 1997 and 98 when I was out there. And that was really my first introduction to immigrant ministries. To dealing with the culture and the conflicts, and the cultural conflicts not between Anglos and Somali or Anglos and Hispanics, but between Hispanics and Somali. When I went from there to be interim at Oliver Presbyterian Church, if you know Phillips neighborhood at all, you know that that Phillips has always been what is called a gateway community, which is the first place that immigrants from around the world have come for generations. It used to be Italians and Germans and Swedes and Norwegians and Finns that were the immigrants that came to the Phillips neighborhood. And they came because housing was cheap. It was cheap to live. Then it became Vietnamese in the 70s. And then in more recent times, it was all these other cultures, Somali being the most recent at that time, and that was in the late 90s, early 2000s. That was my first; those were my first introductions to immigrant ministries. My last church that I was at for 8 years before I retired was at Knox Presbyterian Church, and that's St. Paul Knox, not the Minneapolis Knox. We were a block south of Hamline University in the Midway. If any of you know that neighborhood, that area, it's not an all-white neighborhood. If you just drive down Snelling Avenue, you see Korean restaurants and stores. You see Ethiopian restaurants. You see all sorts of businesses from other parts of the world. And that congregation had tried for years to reflect their neighborhood. And years would go by, and they would try different things, and the congregation got smaller and smaller and smaller, and older and older and older. And so by the time that they brought me in, they were trying to decide whether they should be trying to find a way to grow the congregation or whether they should start figuring out how to close the congregation. And because they were an all-white, very old congregation, and their culture... And that culture isn't just about race or country. It's about age. It's about income levels. It's about a lot of other kinds of things. If you have gray hair and you've got grandchildren, you know what a cultural conflict is. We went and visited our cultural conflicts down in Iowa for Christmas for the first time this last year. I sometimes call them a cultural conflict. Other times I just call them the germ factories because we both come back with colds, which is what happens every time we go see them. But you guys are once again, and I say once again because I know that you used to have a pretty significant number of Cameroons in this congregation. And I understand you still have a couple of families left, but for the most part, they have moved on to other ways and other places. And one of the things that I learned about immigrant ministry is that it's a moving target. Every time you think you're zeroed in on the target, you know where it's at, it moves on you. Either immigration laws change, people get deported, or people move someplace else, or they're a success story and they get jobs that pay them better so they can afford to move into better homes. And then they turn over. And you can either choose to evaluate that and figure out that you did something wrong and that's what happened, and sometimes it is, or you can choose to celebrate that the people that you had are moving on someplace else in life, and you celebrate their going, and then you look around to see what the next group is to come in. I worked with predominantly Indonesian at Knox Presbyterian Church. We brought in a small group of about 12 people, 12 Indonesians, that were meeting with an Indonesian pastor who was doing an advanced degree at Luther Seminary. And he was finishing his degree and had to find someplace else for this group to continue meeting. And I reached out to them, and the first thing they wanted to do was to rent space from Knox. And I said, no, definitely not. We will not rent you any space. You can come and have space to worship, and all that I ask in exchange is that one Sunday a month, we get together and do a joint worship service between the Anglo members, old Anglo members, and your congregation of predominantly young, with young families, a lot of young singles, but also young families with children, small children, and you come to worship with us once a month. And so that's what we did, and we grew it from there. At one point, the Indonesian community was 40% of the congregation. And actually worshiping congregation, probably more than that, because a number of them didn't join as members, but they came and worshiped. And we discovered that there was a lot of stuff to learn from them, that they had a sense of joy in worship that people in their 80s picked up on. They could learn from, could gather from. We found new ways of worshiping using PowerPoint. But instead of doing a word for word translation, which is what I had done with the Lola and Lao community when I was at Oliver, now that stays, we're in better shape. I tried to find ways to, with pictures, to symbolize what I was talking about without doing word-for-word translation, because almost all of them had some English, but they could get the gest. But to try to be able to picture what I'm talking about, I would try to find pictures that simulated what I discussed. Where I was going with this is that I forgot what the lady's name was that told you about the family that you're sponsoring here in just a couple of weeks. You're getting ready for an adventure. I know about the Karen because my daughter, who teaches sixth grade at a school down in Egan Savage School District down there, last spring did what this lady did. Stepped forward to the Minnesota Council of Churches and said, I'd like to organize the teachers and staff at our school to sponsor an immigrant family. And the latest group that's coming now in pretty large numbers is Karen. And the Karen is really not a place, it's a language. And it's the people who live in a part of what used to be Burma. What all of us older folks know as Burma is now Bryn Mawr. But they have been Myanmar, excuse me. In fact, see, it's a good thing she's here. The early service, she wasn't here for, so they got the wrong pronunciation. They were pretty much kicked out of their country because they wanted some autonomy. And we all know what the government has, or many of us know what the government has been like. Just heard on the news this morning that we're stepping towards the process of having ambassadors with that country. I met this family that my daughter works with, and apparently is living in the same apartment complex where your family is going to be living. The children, some of the children at least, have learned to speak passable English enough to translate. They have a wide range of ages. They have a wide range of experiences. This family is, I think they said, you said 16 years. I think some of them that my daughter has met has been there at 20, 25 years. Entire generations have never known living any place other than in a refugee camp. So they're asked when they come to this country that each person is allowed to bring one small suitcase. And they have to figure out what is most important to them to bring. You want to know what's not most important to them that doesn't get brought? Sheets, towels, pillows, other kinds of white goods. I haven't looked at your list out there, but that's one of the things that they're always desperately short on. The other thing that they don't have is they don't have coats. They have no idea what this weather's like. The only shoes that I'll guarantee you that any of them in this family will have will be thongs or sandals. So they need shoes and boots and winter coats right away. Take them with you when you go to the airport to meet them and pick them up, or make sure that somebody does if Minnesota Council of Churches doesn't. You may have worked with Minnesota Council of Churches in years past where when a church sponsored a family, you were with that family for years and years and years and years. It's no longer that way. When they come, they get 6 months of support from the Minnesota Council of Churches. In that first 6 months, they have to learn enough English to be able to get a job. They have to be able to earn enough money to pay their own rent and their own food. And they have to get, so they're starting from zero and moving to that in a very short amount of time. And they need help. Need help doing that. Many of them end up working in Albert Lea and Austin in the meatpacking plants. There's a van that every Monday morning early, very early, in the middle of the night practically, comes and picks up workers and drives them to the men. These are almost all men that are doing the meat cutting. Take them down to meatpacking plants and leaves them there, and they have six, eight, ten of the men will live in a small house together, or they'll share an apartment for the week. And then on Friday night, when their shift is over, the vans bring them back again, and they're back for the weekend with their families. And that's how they can get enough living quick enough to be able to get off assistance within 6 months. But that's a lot of pressure. And every dime is accounted for, and they have to work with. The shirt that you see me wearing is, I've got a closet full of these. This is called batik, and it's a silk screening printing process, but it's all done by hand. No two are the same. And this comes from the Indonesian community that we worked with for many years. Every time that I would help someone who was having trouble with immigration or ended up in detention center, in jail, because almost always it was because somebody in immigration had messed up on paperwork. It was almost never the Indonesians. Every time I helped them get a lawyer or did whatever, or if I went to visit somebody that was sick, help them with prayers for somebody that was sick back in Indonesia that they couldn't be with. The next time that they had visitors come from Indonesia to visit them, they brought Pastor Dan the largest batik shirt that they could find. And so I've got a closet full of these. At Thanksgiving, it was just going to be for Thanksgiving, my wife, my daughter, and her husband, and I for Thanksgiving dinner. And my daughter asked, could I bring the Korean family to Thanksgiving dinner? So we said, sure. And then she ended up bringing also another junior high girl whose English was better to help to interpret. And we talked about what life was like in their country and our custom of Thanksgiving and about being thankful for. And most of the Korean you're going to find are already Christian by tradition. So you're not starting from zero. In fact, there is a Korean-speaking church down not too far from where the apartments are, where they're going to be living. The next Sunday, my daughter came with three young teenage girls to the church that we worship at, which is at Parkview Press, UCC Church that we go to. And they came with a sack with a shirt in it. The Korean people are weavers. And it's a hand-woven shirt. They brought one for my wife that's just lovely, very fancy, intricate needlework on it, and one for myself. If I'd have known you guys were getting a Korean family, I would have worn the Korean shirt instead of my Indonesian ones, because I haven't even worn it yet. But finding ways of welcoming them into your homes, not just providing them with a home, but and when they get settled, invite them to come for a meal. Share food with them. You're going to find, if you actually look at Scripture, the most outreach that Jesus did throughout the Gospels was around food. Either the serving of food, feeding of the 5,000, communion, breaking of bread, number of others, or the growing of food and sharing it, the planting of seeds. And it's still a great way to reach out to the immigrant community, in this case, the Karen community. And you're going to find that you're going to be as richly blessed as what they are. So that was my little extension. Now I got to go fast to try to make up for it. One of those parables that Jesus told around food was the sowing of seed. The sowing of seed, it doesn't say what kind of seed. In reality, the seed that they would be sowing would be seed that was sown for food. But we don't know that. That's not the point of the parable. The point of the parable that he is sowing is the sower is God. The seed is God's word. And we're, as God's helper, can be placed in that vision as well. And what it's trying to say is that God's word, God's seed, gets thrown and sown wherever it will, wherever it might. You know, if I was raised on a farm. I'm a farm boy from Illinois originally. And we prepared our soil for the seed. That wasn't the way culturally that it was done in the Bible times. They would kind of go around with a sharp stick and make a few holes if they could get in and throw a little seed down. Otherwise, they threw it wherever it was. Some of it fell on rocky ground. Some of it fell on good ground. Some of it, there was thorns and needles already growing, starting to grow, and they had a head start on the seed, so they would grow up and choke out the seed. But you would still end up getting a crop at some point. Some ground just isn't good for growing much of anything. I heard about a person who was a gardener who moved to a new home, new place, and wanted to start his garden in his new house that he went to, and just didn't know what to do. He didn't know what he could raise. You know, I mean, there's a vast variety of things that we can grow climate-wise, but he went to the local garden center and he tracked down the manager, and he said, "I've got a problem." He says, I want to plant a garden, but I don't know what kind of seed to grow. He said, my problem is multiple. He says, I get about 2 hours of sunlight a day is all. And those 2 hours, the sun is blazing, it's bright, there's no breeze because there's a fence on one side, a building on the other, and the sunlight bounces off the building onto the ground, and every time I try to plant anything, it just shrivels up and dies. You can't keep enough moisture on it. It's just hard as a rock. Can't do anything with it. And then and the guy says, well, what kind of soil do you have? And he says, tell you the truth, it's just not very good. It's hard as a rock. It's mostly clay and rock. I've got a lot of sections with a lot of rock in it, too. What do you suggest that I grow? And the garden center manager thought a minute, and he said, well, why don't you go over here to aisle B? We've got a whole display. You just got in a brand new display of bird baths and flower of flagpoles and bird baths. Well, for some places, that's about the only thing you can get to grow. You know something? I've known some congregations who say that they want to grow, and they want God's word to grow, and they want their numbers to grow, and they want to harvest God's bounty. And yet, they don't want to change the way they do anything. They don't want to learn from anybody else. They don't want to welcome anyone that's different than them. The only thing that can grow in those kinds of churches is flagpoles, and almost every church that you go to, someplace in the sanctuary has a flag, national flag and a Christian flag. They can grow those okay, and bird baths. If you look around, most of them have a baptismal font someplace that, for all the good it gets used, it might as well be a bird bath. So flagpoles and bird baths is the only thing that that kind of ground is going to get. You know, there are some things that I would like us to look at in this parable about who does the sowing and when will the crops grow. You see, one of the things that you've got to learn from this text is that you don't have to be someone special to sow seeds of the kingdom. You don't have to be a superstar. You don't have to be a celebrity. You don't have to be Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie. You don't have to have a lot of money. One of the surest teachings in Scripture is that anybody can be used by God to do the work of the kingdom. You want to come up a second? Next slide, please. This group of ladies are known as babushkas. They're Russian. I've never met them. I just found the picture on the internet. But the third one, the one that sits in the middle, that could be my mother. You see, my mom turns 90 years old in April, and she goes to a very, very small Methodist church in a town of 2,000 people. It's Grace Methodist. They've already got a First Methodist church, which is referred to as the Big Methodist Church. and there the small Methodist church. And her lady friends could just as well be that group right there. It's mostly people like that, ladies like that. A few men, but mostly it's the women. They're all past presidents of the WSCS, Women's Society of Christian Service, if you're ever Methodist. If they were Presbyterian, it would be the PW. And anybody who wants to do anything in that church, if they're smart, they go to the former WSCS ladies and tell them what needs to be done. And if they give it the okay, the approval, it'll happen. My experience in 30 years of pastoring Presbyterian churches is that the surest way for a pastor to get himself in trouble is to try to do something without running it by the women of the church first. This group of ladies is just a sampling of a much larger group of babushkas. Babushkas had been the butts of jokes in both Russia and the Western world for decades or longer. I'd like to tell you about this group of ladies. You see, in Moscow in August of 1991, it was a very tense and dangerous time with the old Soviet regime giving way to the new social order. Boris Yeltsin and a small group of defenders occupied the Russian White House and successfully managed to face off an enormous number of tanks and troops who were being led by the military generals that were trying to overthrow this newly formed type of government that they were doing. They were circled around what's referred to as the Russian White House with tanks and troops and soldiers. Surprisingly, a key role in this conflict was the successful resistance that was played by the babushkas, the old women of the church. You see, the bandana-wearing old grandmothers who had kept the Orthodox Church alive for years during the Soviet period had been the butt of jokes, and nothing could have been more pathetic and irrelevant than these old women, all hunched over and wrapped up in their woolen shawls. They were widely regarded as evidence of the eventual death of religion in the old Soviet Union. And yet, on that critical night, on August 20th, 1991, martial law was proclaimed and people were commanded to go to their homes and stay there, many of these babushkas, these old women, disobeyed, and they went instead to the place of confrontation. Some of them fed the resistors in a public display of support. Others staffed medical stations to take care of people that were injured. Others prayed for a miracle. And yet still others, astoundingly, climbed up on the tanks, peered through the little slits that the drivers of the tanks and the gunners were looking through, and they looked at the crew-cut young men inside and told them there were new orders. These new orders came from God, they said. Thou shalt not kill. And you know what happened? The young men stopped the tanks. I mean, who wants to run over their grandmother or anybody's grandmother? The attack never came. You see, you don't have to be extraordinarily gifted to help determine history. The history of a nation, the history of the world. There's no better evidence of that than what's found in Scripture itself, especially the Old Testament. Very few of the heroes of the Old Testament are historic at all. They did some really stupid things, but God still used them, just as God uses you and me today. You don't have to be someone special to sow seeds of the kingdom. However, you do need to be committed. Now, this is the most important secret in life. You and I can accomplish extraordinary things if we are willing to pay the price. Next one. There we go. On June 1st, 2001, a young Arab man named Saad Hatari strapped a load of explosives to his body and walked into downtown Tel Aviv. He waited until he was surrounded by a crowd of Israeli citizens. And then Hatari triggered the bomb. 21 Israelis died that day, among them Hatari himself. As soon as the news reached Saad Hatari's community, his family and his friends began celebrating. To them, he was a hero. The Palestinians who commit these bombings and those who celebrate them believe that a jihad, a holy act of war, is the highest form of religious service. And anyone who dies in a jihad is guaranteed to go straight to paradise. The Hamas is the military Palestinian group, the militant Palestinian group that is that is behind many of the bombings that have happened in recent years in that part of the world. They believe that in educating young children into the glories of jihad. There are signs along the walls in Hamas-run schools extolling the heroism of suicide bombers. An 11-year-old boy in one Hamas school announced, I make my body a bomb that will blast away the flesh of the Zionists. I will tear their bodies into little pieces and cause them more pain than they have ever known. Saad Hatari's proud father remarks that he hopes that Saad's brothers and friends follow his example and become suicide bombers too. As he says, there is no better way to show God that you love him. Isn't that scary? That's a concept, that's a cultural concept that we just don't understand, can't understand. It's so foreign to everything that we know. Many people at one point in the last 10 years or another thought that sending our young men and women to Afghanistan was a good and noble cause. Many still do. But every time that one of our young people have been killed, we grieved. We didn't celebrate. We were proud of their service, yes. But not one parent of those children wouldn't trade that service for their son or daughter's life back. It's a foreign concept. This concept we see as misguided, of course, even demonic. But it's also a level of commitment that most of us don't know anything about. There is a better way to show God that you love him than a suicide bombing. Rather, I would suggest that one way, instead of dying for God, is living for God. How about becoming a sower of seeds? You don't have to be someone special to sow the seeds of the kingdom. But you do need to be committed. You don't have to know how to, you don't have to know what you believe particularly. You do need to know that you believe and search for what you believe. And you have to give yourself completely to that belief. You know, we live in a world of good intentions. But good intentions won't get the job done. To make a difference in the world requires a high level of commitment. Most of you, I think, who are my age or near my age, probably grew up in a time when you would hear about missionaries. And one of the greatest aspirations was to grow up and to become a missionary. A lot of women of my age and slightly younger even, the idea of becoming a pastor was out of the question. It didn't happen. It wasn't possible in our culture. But they could become missionaries. And they would hear stories about going to faraway places and taking the Word of God to these places. But more importantly, being a medical missionary, where they would nurse people back to health, or they would heal the sick, or they would help people build better housing, better sanitation, all those kinds of things. Somehow it seemed far off, and it seemed distance, but it seemed something that could be done. Going to seminary and becoming a pastor was much harder. It was harder culturally for women. It was unheard of. But it was not easy for men either. It took money to do. And many of us didn't have money to even think about that. So you'll find many pastors my age and older, or about my age, who ended up going to seminary probably for something less than just reasons. The ones who were younger and went to seminary at that time, in the 60s and early 70s. Any guess why they went? Many of them? Vietnam. Vietnam was the motivation for many young men to finish college, and then in order to keep their student deferment, they had to do something, and one option was to go to seminary, graduate school. And then after you graduated, then it was only natural, because there was a shortage of pastors at that time. Somewhat, you got a job; it didn't pay much, but you didn't get drafted if you were a pastor. Now, see, I got it all backwards, because I went and served my 4 years in the military first, and then I got out, and after working a number of other jobs, went to seminary. But that's how a lot of them got there. But God works in different kinds of ways. And sometimes they work outside the church as well. You don't have to be someone special to sow seeds of the kingdom, but you do need to be committed. We live in a world of these good intentions. But good intentions alone won't get it done. To make a difference in the world requires a high level of commitment. In 1998, 16-year-old Alden Tucker read a news story about Michael Pannone. He was a 15-year-old boy of multiracial heritage. He had contracted leukemia, and Michael's only hope for recovery was a bone marrow transplant. Unfortunately, his ethnic heritage, exotic ethnic heritage, you see, he was African-American, Hispanic, and Korean. Pretty tough mix. Drastically reduced his chances of finding a matching donor. Alan Tucker, who read about this in the paper, was also of that same ethnic mix. So he immediately volunteered to serve as a donor. But bone marrow donations are invasive and they're painful procedures. And federal law prohibited bone marrow testing, even testing, for people who were under 18 years of age. Well, Alan Tucker wasn't about to take no for an answer. So he began talking to reporters and legislators about changing the consent laws for bone marrow donation. He also met and befriended Michael Pannone. And just before Michael's death in 1999, Alden promised him that he would never give up the campaign to change bone marrow donation laws. In March of 2000, the Michael Pannone law allowing bone marrow testing and donation by people under the age of 18 with the consent of a parent was signed into law in the state of Washington. It wasn't in time for Michael, but because of Alden's persistence, it exists today. He was only a teenager, but Alden Tucker made a difference. So can you, and so can I, if we are willing to pay the price. You know, that's why a cross stands at the center of our worship. Whether it physically stands here, or whether it's on a screen, or whether it symbolically stands here, the cross is at the center of worship. Of course, we can't see into the mind of God, but Christ dying on the cross is a reminder to us that if our lives are to have any impact on our world, we're going to have to give our lives to something bigger than ourselves. Nothing in life worthwhile is obtained without sacrifice. Someone has to sacrifice to build a successful marriage. Actually, two someones. Someone has to sacrifice to produce children who are healthy mentally, spiritually, physically. Someone has to sacrifice to build a successful company or a successful community or a successful church. Humanity never moves forward unless someone is willing to go beyond the effort of the ordinary or the average. Gordon Giesbrecht is the director of the Laboratory for Exercise and Environmental Medicine at the University of Manitoba, just to our north. His nickname is Professor Popsicle. Now, this is not a sign of disrespect. Professor Giesbrecht has spent his career studying the effects of extreme cold on the human body. He quite literally immerses himself in his subject. Throughout the course of his career, Professor Giesbrecht has induced hypothermia, extremely low body temperatures, on himself 37 times. He regularly exposes himself to freezing temperatures and records the effects that those temperatures have on his physical and mental health. His research has led to life-saving advances in treating victims of exposure and hypothermia. We do not know if Dr. Griesbecht is more brilliant than other scientists, but we do know that he has a high degree of commitment to climb into a tub of water filled with ice 37 times for the sake of science. Tells us he's committed. We know that God was committed to saving humanity from its own foolish ways. How do we know? Because of the cross. Now, you and I want to go through life on the cheap, don't we? If we're honest with ourselves, we don't really want to pay the price. Most churches have a stewardship time in the fall of the year, and somebody, someplace, somehow tries to give you a pledge card, or we try to play games with it. So we used to call it an estimate of giving card, or some other kind of thing that didn't sound like you were signing a contract of any sort. And then some people, some churches, even have the nerve to actually ask their people to give 10% of their income. Oh, if somebody gives 5% or 7%, we think that they must be angelic saints to give all that. I told you about the Indonesian community. One of the things that the Anglos learned from the Indonesian community is the Indonesians came, when they came here, they were already Christian, most of them. The Muslim faith is very rapidly growing, and a lot of the conflict that happens in Indonesia is between Muslim and Christian. But the Christians came from a tradition of tithing. Many of the Indonesians that came that we worked with, when they first come, at least until they get all their paperwork worked out, the only kind of jobs that they could get was as dishwashers in restaurants. Or maybe they worked their way up to cooks. Or they were cashiers. You know how much money those kind of people make? They would love to make a minimum wage, but they don't. They work very long hours. And if they make $4 or $5 an hour, they're thrilled. But I discovered that my treasurer could tell me every time that one of the Indonesians got a raise or got a demotion or lost hours. Because she could tell to the penny how much their paycheck that week was. Because they gave 10% to the church. It didn't matter if they made $50 that week or they made $500 that week. They gave 10% off the top. And then every time that we had a special offering, if we did the Christmas Joy offering or we did the One Great Hour of Sharing offering or when the tsunami hit Indonesia and we took an offering to send to Indonesia, they gave extra above and beyond their 10%. That came first. That was commitment. That kind of commitment is the kinds of things that you can learn from people from other parts of the world. Now, unfortunately, many times people from other places become assimilated and they become too much like us. And then they end up discovering that the Anglos, they don't tithe. They don't give 10%. They don't give 7%. They don't give 5%. They just give spare change. And oftentimes they end up becoming Americanized in that way, which is always a shame. But if we have the opportunity to listen, we find that we don't have to go through life on the cheap. That we don't have to just get by on the minimum effort. If we try it, it simply doesn't work. So I ask you, what kind of seed are you sowing in the lives of those that you love? What kind of seed are you sowing in your community, in the world for which Christ died? Will this be a better world because you've been here? Some of you know me or may have heard or noticed that my hairstyle isn't just bald. It's because I've been going through chemotherapy for the last almost 2 years now. I got diagnosed in May of 2000 with stage 4 lung cancer. What that means is stage 4 means is that you're dying. It's just a matter of when. They told me, the doctors told me when they gave me that diagnosis, when I asked, how long does that mean I have? And the doctor said, well, if we do nothing, maybe you have 8 months. And we can control pain, do pain management. And that was it. She says, I think with some chemotherapy, I think you can probably live 2 years. But science is always coming along, and they're always coming up with new kinds of treatments, and you never know. She says, the longest I've ever seen anybody live with your kind of cancer is 4 years. You get that kind of diagnosis, it makes you think a little bit about life. It makes you wonder what kind of seeds you've sown. It makes you think about your children. It makes you think about how you spent your working career. And I've decided that there are just a few things that I want to be remembered for when my time comes. One, I want to be remembered for as being a father who raised some caring kids. My oldest son is getting his doctorate right now, while he's at the same time that he's serving 3 Methodist churches down in the southwest corner of Iowa. He'll get his doctorate degree in May. In fact, he's on sabbatical right now, finishing up his dissertation. My number 2 son is a third or fourth grade now. He's teaching third, I think. Is a third grade teacher he's currently in Japan teaching. He spent 3 years teaching in China before he got to Japan. He's married to a Japanese woman and has 2 lovely half Japanese, half American kids, boys. My youngest one is my daughter, and she teaches 6th grade now in immigrant-rich communities. She taught for 2 years in Houston, Texas, which is a lot of immigrant community, before she got a job back up here. And she's been 3 years now. This is her 3rd year teaching back in Minnesota, and reaching out with all kinds of kids. And I'm very proud of my kids. Some of them are smarter than others. But they all have compassionate hearts. And that's what I've been most proud of, is that they have learned to be compassionate. And they've learned to dedicate themselves to something. That's my number one thing that I want to be remembered for. The other thing I want to be remembered for is to be remembered as an immigrant pastor. Someone who cared when others didn't. Someone who tried to bring justice in an unjust world. Notice I said tried to, because there's still a lot of injustice out there. That's all. If I can be thankful, and I am thankful for those 2 things, having raised my kids and having reached out to the immigrant community, what more could I ask? And you want to know something else? The doctor gave me some parameters of how long I have to live. But the message was that I'm dying. But you know the message today is, you're dying too. Every single one of you is going to die. Don't wait for a doctor to give you a diagnosis of months or years. Decide today. Decide what seeds you want to have grown before you die. Regardless of the soil, whether it's good, rich soil and you get 100-fold, or it's rocky soil and you don't get a whole lot back, be thankful for each little bit and sow some more seeds while you can.